Next case is 09553 ABN Emerald Mortgage Group versus Jacob Kanga. Ms. Perk.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Got your time there on the clock.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Sikora, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kelly K. Perk, Assistant Prosecuting Attorney for Cuyahoga County, Ohio, Civil Division. This morning I'm representing the Board of Cuyahoga County Commissioners, Department of Development. We are the appellants in this matter. And today, we are asking the court to resolve a certified conflict concerning the application of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. Specifically, the Department of Development asked that this court reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals and hold that the doctrine of equitable subrogation does not apply to give a lender's mortgage priority over a validly recorded prior mortgage where the lender or third-party title examiner providing title work for the lender negligently fails to discover the prior mortgage.
Counsel, in the situation here, it's my understanding that the secondary, the loan that was used for the down payment, the $7,500, was always a second mortgage on this Maple Heights home, correct?
It was originally a second mortgage.
Originally, and then subsequently with the refinance, it was still in second place.
No, my client expressly agreed only to be in second place to the original first
the
mortgage.
The practical application here, at the end, when the mortgage was paid off and then the second mortgage was in place, you still found yourself in second place.
No, we were then recorded first because our mortgage was recorded in 2000 and the ABN AMRO mortgage was recorded in 2001. So we were in first place then. And according to
that's your argument here if we don't apply equitable estoppel or equitable subrogation, correct?
I mean, that's the undisputed order of recording. If we apply equitable subrogation to the benefit of ABN, ABN would then take
first place, and you would be in the situation that you were in relationship to the original mortgage.
That's correct.
Okay. So if you were satisfied being second in the first mortgage, what's the issue with being second in the second mortgage?
The issue is that, that there are several issues. First, my client, the Department of Development, does on occasion entertain a request to continue to be in second place. If the homeowner wants to refinance their mortgage, the homeowner and the new mortgage company would submit paperwork to my client, and my client could review the paperwork, see if the terms were favorable to both the homeowner and my client's investment, and possibly agree again to subordinate its interest to the new first mortgage. In this case, because the title examiner missed my client's mortgage, my client was not approached and did not have the ability to review the terms or the amount of the new first mortgage, placing my client's mortgage at greater risk than it had been in the first place.
Was the second mortgage at a greater amount than the first?
The second mortgage was for $77,000, and the original first mortgage was $68,916. So what that did, because they missed our mortgage, the property is now over-mortgaged. It's mortgaged more than the value of the property. The property is now appraised by the Cuyahoga County Auditor at about $80,300. So
if there was a default on the new second, now first mortgage, as the case holds, if it went into foreclosure, your client would be out.
Due to the foreclosure crisis and the dramatic drop in property values, especially in Cuyahoga County, that's correct. My client will likely not recover any money. And the note that my client, the note in this case does not allow my client to recover a deficiency judgment.
If your client, if you were properly contacted about a refinance if they had not missed the mortgage. What is generally the practice? Do you sometimes say no? Do you say yes? What do you look at?
Sometimes say no, sometimes say yes. They want to make sure that the interest rate is not too high. They want to make sure that the monthly payments are not too onerous for the homeowner, and they want to make sure that the loan-to-value ratio is appropriate. And in this case, it was not, because then the property was over-mortgaged, making it more likely, well, the property now has negative equity, and making it more likely that the property owner would default on the mortgage and just simply walk away, causing the property to go into foreclosure.
And if your client had said no, they would have two options. They could continue paying on the original note or buy you out.
That's correct. Or they could, you know, try to work out some other terms. If you know, the homeowner could go to another mortgage company to see if they could get better terms that my client would agree to, or work with ABN AMRO to possibly get better terms that my client would agree to.
Counsel, in looking at the county's note and mortgage, there is nothing in the note or mortgage that says the homeowner may not refinance, is there?
No, and it happens a lot. Homeowners do often refinance. And in this case, I believe the original first mortgage, it was a higher interest rate, and it was an adjustable rate mortgage. So it would make sense for the homeowner to refinance.
And your mortgage had refers to itself as a subordinate security interest. And I guess my question would be, because I guess there's no real question that there is a doctrine of equitable subrogation. There may be several variations of that and which should apply, but if they did find this mortgage, why would they not understand it to mean that it would be secondary in any event, even though it is now recorded, you know, first in time, but it says it is subordinate to the first mortgage. So why would it not, why would that not lead credence to the fact that the lender here would have first priority?
It also said that it was subordinate only to the First Ohio mortgage. It was subordinate only to that one. It did, and to its assigns and successors, which I believe the original first mortgage was assigned to Countrywide. So they took the place of the First Ohio mortgage loan. I can't speak for ABN AMRO or the title examiner, but if I were lending $77,000 to somebody to be secured by a mortgage, I would, and if I saw the $7,500 mortgage, I would at least address it and not ignore it. I think that would be commercially reasonable to do, and not just ignore a $7,500 mortgage that's now in first place and hope for the best luck down the road.
Ms. Burke, what is the law in the 8th District on this subject, to the best of your knowledge?
I believe the 8th District, from my understanding of the opinion, follows, I guess it's the majority rule or the restatement rule, that if it's a mere mistake, then that will not defeat a party's claim to equitable subrogation. My response to that would be, you know, how negligent does a lender have to be deprived of the doctrine of equitable subrogation? And I believe that the burden should be on the lender to prove that it, you know, it was a mere mistake or it was an immaterial mistake. I don't believe the mistake here was immaterial, because it did place my client's loan at risk. And my client's loan is taxpayer-funded money. This is taxpayer money that is going to fund these programs, these down payment assistance programs, these rehabilitation loan programs. And now my client is also involved in assisting homeowners catch up on their first mortgages so their homes do not fall into foreclosure. So these monies are, you know, once, if we recoup them, either through the sale of the property or in a foreclosure sale, that money is not, you know, profit to the county. That money is used to assist other homeowners in Cuyahoga County.
Well, I think the legal question here is an important one. We have to decide whether to adopt the restatement view, which I think is the traditional view, or these variations of that view, which is the minority view or the moderate, so-called moderate view. Why should, and the appellee argues, do you agree that the majority view, which is the view that was applied by the Court of Appeals here, seems to be the view in the adopted in most states that have issued opinions on this?
I would agree by the numbers that is true.
Why should we be different?
Well, this court does have some precedent. In State v. Jones, there was a state tax lien that the lender missed by its own negligence. And this court held that the lender's dilemma was in its control, and the hiring of the title examiner was in its control, and that their own improvident business management led to the predicament that they were in. That's very similar to where we are now. Their own title examiner missed our mortgage. It wasn't any fault of my client. My client properly recorded its mortgage, took every precaution to protect its interest.
That's true. I think the rationale for the majority view, or the traditional view, is that you go back to the intention of the parties, and you argue that your second position was only with respect to the first loan, but if we adopt the majority view in the country, or the traditional view, then we say, don't we, that we look to the original intent of the parties, that your lien would be second, ABN would be first, and the fact that the fact that someone superseded or succeeded to the first loan doesn't change the intention of the parties. What's your argument to that? Is it still that the documents indicate that you were to be second only with respect to the first mortgage?
Yes, the documents specifically say that. They specifically list or spell out that we were to be subordinate only to the first Ohio mortgage.
So it is your argument that we, I don't want to make your argument for you, but it's your argument that we could adopt the traditional view, but in applying it to this case, if we look at the mortgage documents, the original mortgage documents, that we could conclude that the county's, the development department's intention was to be second only with respect to the first mortgage company.
That's correct, and that the intention of the Department of Development was, if there was a refinance, that the Department of Development would be approached by the homeowner and the new lender to work that out.
Is that in writing anyplace?
It's a policy of the Department of Development. I'm not sure if it's in writing. And I do see that I only have less than 3 minutes left, so if there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Burke. Mr. Sikora.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm Mike Sikora, and I represent Appalee ABN Mortgage Group, Incorporated. Constructive notice is not enough to deprive a party of its right to assert the doctrine of equitable subrogation. The certified question should be answered in the affirmative.
What's the point of checking title?
Your Honor, the point of checking...
If that's the rule.
Your Honor...
Why ever check a title?
The point of checking title is, in the vast majority of transactions in which there are multiple liens that encumber the same property, the traditional elements of the doctrine of equitable subrogation don't apply. There's only a very small percentage. A title examiner checking title could never possibly envision ignoring liens or not checking title, hoping that the doctrine of equitable subrogation would actually apply, because the elements of the doctrine actually have to be satisfied. And as a practical matter, it's a very, very small percentage of cases in which this unique fact pattern that's before you today actually exists.
What's unique about it?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, you have to have a prior lien that's satisfied. Second of all, the lender asserting the doctrine has to have the intent to hold the first and best lien. That's not present in many cases. And the second traditional element.
Of course they had the intent to have a first and best lien, and that's why they checked title.
That's true, Your Honor. That is why title examinations either by lenders or title companies are prevalent in the state of Ohio.
So why didn't they just sue the title examiner?
Well, Your Honor, the purpose of the doctrine...
Isn't that the normal course of things where you're dealing with this? is when the title examiner makes a mistake, it's pay up.
The purpose of the doctrine of equitable subrogation, according to this court, and it's the most important element of the doctrine of equitable subrogation, is to prevent windfalls to the competing lien holders that would otherwise result. And in these situations...
Hey, what was the amount of the first mortgage?
The amount of the first mortgage that was satisfied, Your Honor, was $69,500. And that's
So what was the amount of the second first mortgage, the mortgage that your client...
It was $77,000, Your Honor, but the amount
of... So what's the difference there?
About $7,500, Your Honor.
And what did the county loan?
$7,500, Your Honor.
There you go.
Your Honor, the doctrine of equitable subrogation only allows my client to step into the shoes of the prior lien that it satisfied. To that extent, that's it, period. Nothing more. So the thrust of the doctrine, according to this court and the majority of courts throughout the country, is to prevent windfalls.
So if this client or this mortgagee defaulted, you would be only claiming $67,000 in a court of law against him?
Your Honor, the total amount claimed against the mortgagor is actually $71,000, which was the amount owed. But based upon the doctrine of equitable subrogation, as the trial court and the court of appeals correctly held in this case, we're only entitled to subrogation in the first position to the extent of the prior lien that we satisfied, because that's the amount of the lien.
Do you know of any case where a mortgage company has come in and said, because we missed the first lien, we're only going to claim the amount of the first mortgage on this case that we placed?
Well, Your Honor, that's, in terms of priority, that's all ABN can claim in terms of first position.
And if that's the case, then what is the problem with this mortgage being first? Because you say you can't, you don't get an offset for it, you only get what the first bank held, you loan $7,500 more, you're not going to claim the $7,500, so what's the problem with the first lien still being the first lien?
Well, Your Honor, my client would claim the $7,500. I think it's important to remember the property hasn't been sold yet, so ultimately the loss cannot be measured.
You said your client would claim the $7,500?
As against the borrower, Your Honor, it would, but with respect to first lien priority, my client is only entitled to priority, first lien priority, in the amount of the first $69,500, because that is the amount that unquestionably had priority over appellant. Next in line would then be appellant in the amount of its $7,500. And then to the extent that there is any deficiency, ABN or any other lender in this situation would then be third in line. To the extent that it's not satisfied in the amount of that first lien that it paid that unquestionably had priority over appellants. So
you're not in any different position. The $7,500 still has priority over the difference. So why not have it stay on the books as the first lien now?
It depends upon the amount that the property actually sells for, Your Honor. And the point of the doctrine of equitable subrogation is that the competing lien holder, the appellant, is in no worse position. The competing
Why would any lender ask for a waiver of a second lien holder, a material man's lien? Why would they ever ask for that if your theory of this is correct?
Well, Your Honor, it depends upon which view of the doctrine of equitable subrogation this court would adopt. If this court would adopt the traditional view of the doctrine as it seemed to apply as far back as 1896 in Joyce versus Dance, where it said that a party asserting the doctrine need not be ignorant of the competing lien. If this court follows it's the traditional view that it seems to have followed, then it wouldn't have an incentive to ask for a release or subordination from a competing lien if that competing lien was junior and the amount of the refinance was equivalent to the amount of the prior lien being satisfied. And that is actually one of the policy reasons for supporting the traditional view of the doctrine of equitable subrogation, is it promotes refinances and can help borrowers in situations where they need a refinance. It's important to remember, this is a classic case that illustrates that point, because the prior lien in this case was held by Countrywide, and it was a one-year ARM note that was scheduled to adjust in 2 to 3 months from the time this transaction took place, and it was potentially going to be a 2.75% interest rate adjustment. And this was a 30-year fixed rate at favorable terms that this borrower locked in with ABN.
Counsel.
Well, let me ask you another, a little hypothetical off of this to see where this takes us. What if the the county's note and mortgage said that the borrower could not refinance without the permission of the county, and the title examiner missed this mortgage and note, the refinancing took place, and we're in the situation we're in? Would the doctrine of equitable subrogation, as you're urging this court to apply, apply?
It would, Your Honor. Regardless of whether this court would adopt the traditional view or the moderate view, it would. And that's essentially a variation of the argument that appellant has made to this court, that it can, by its own terms in its document, eliminate the application of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. Appellant argued to you today that because its mortgage twice says that it's to be a subordinate security instrument, and it references the document that it's supposed to be subordinate to.
But that's a little different than the an express prohibition on the borrower.
Well, Your Honor, I agree. It is a little bit different, but regardless of the language that's employed by the junior lien holder, if it has the ability to include such language or some variation of it, it can exempt itself from the doctrine of equitable subrogation, and contractually a party can render the doctrine of equitable subrogation null and void throughout
Doesn't
the state.
Doesn't that go to intent, though, and the original intent of the parties? The original intent of the parties, would there be no refinancing, no stepping into the shoes?
Your Honor, this court has actually very carefully made a distinction on that point. Intent of the lender asserting the doctrine is important. Expectation of the competing lien holder at the time it takes its interest with respect to priority is the most important element of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. Expectation of the competing lien holder is the most important element in the five decisions from this court on equitable subrogation. What expectation did it have with respect to priority at the time that it received its interest?
Well, on that point, what is your response to Ms. Perk's assertion that the expectation here of the county was that it was to be second only to the mortgage of First Ohio Mortgage?
Your Honor, with respect to that point, the document itself says that it was to be a subordinate security instrument, and then it goes on to reference
the
document.
She says that that also includes the language we'll find in the record, but she says it'll also refers to First Ohio Mortgage. Is that significant, if that's true?
It does refer to the First Ohio Mortgage, but I think, first of all, Your Honor, it's important to remember that in the vast majority of transactions in which the doctrine of equitable subrogation applies, including the decisions that this court has addressed, there was no such language present at all. And the court looked at the record and said, at the time that interest was received, what was that party's expectation with respect to priority?
Okay, let's examine that. You're now representing the holder of a second mortgage. What are your expectations with respect to a home that has a first on it? Would one of your expectations be that the borrower, the homeowner, would be making payments, and that your position with respect to the equity keeps moving up? That is, the first, the amount of debt owed on the first begins to decline, and so your position just gets better with time. Wouldn't that be the normal expectation?
That could be a reasonable expectation, Your
Honor. That would be universally the expectation, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, actually, the competing lien in favor of appellant doesn't actually call for payment until the property is sold. It doesn't provide for any interest rate, doesn't call for any payment until the property is sold. And
okay,
more specifically,
but it's positioned right on top of a first mortgage. So the expectation is things are going to improve from here.
And, Your Honor, the doctrine is carefully crafted to address that point, because it leaves the competing lien holder in no worse position than it expected. And at the time this refinance took place, this borrower was facing rolling off a one-year ARM that would have had an increased interest rate. And the refinance didn't call for any payment to appellant, and the amount satisfied on the Countrywide mortgage is the only amount.
What happened to the additional funds that this homeowner acquired? Or were there additional funds?
Your Honor, none of those additional funds went to the borrower. The funds were used for various purposes: casualty insurance, real estate tax advancements, appraisal fees.
Well, you know, well, that, now that's a wonderful loan, isn't it? It managed, he really improved himself.
Well, Your Honor,
he went from owing $68,000 to owing $77,000, and he gave it all to your client.
Did not
for
give
this,
it,
this
did,
great improvement in interest.
Did not give it to my client, Your Honor. The settlement statement is in the record, and you will see casualty insurance advances, appraisal fees, fees paid to a number of other parties besides my client and the mortgage broker that it hired. And I think it's important to remember that these loan terms were favorable, and this borrower continued to make payments on the ABN
right,
loan.
Counsel, let me ask a question that kind of dovetails on Justice Pfeiffer's questions. If there is not a provision for payment of this second mortgage to the county until the property is sold, isn't it a real expectation and a reasonable expectation that the county holding this mortgage does not expect the borrower to overmortgage the property?
No. Your Honor, in this situation, I think when it comes to application of the doctrine of equitable subrogation, the expectation relates to priority, and the competing lien holder is behind $69,500, and it's a loan that the borrower continued to pay on for 5.5 years after this transaction took place. So although over-mortgaging is part of your question, there's a lot of speculation inherent in that question, because the borrower could have found himself in default within 2 to 3 months of this transaction taking place when his 1-year ARM interest rate increased.
Well, yeah, he could have, and then you still would have had your base of $69,000, and the county would have had a $7,500 bill, and you would have sold the property theoretically for its appraised value, which would have sent everybody home with money in their pocket. And because of the over-mortgaging here, you know, that's, chances are that's not going to happen, and also given the real estate market. Now, I have one more question. One of the three reasons that the appellate court gives is for finding the doctrine of equitable subrogation is that ABN intended to hold the first and best lien on the property, and that the county agreed to a subordinate security interest, and the title company's failure to discover the second mortgage was a mere mistake. And I don't see any definition of a mere mistake. And what does that mean legally? If we're to determine, you know, what version of equitable subrogation, if any, what does mere mistake mean?
Your Honor,
in the context of a title company, how does a title company make a mere mistake as opposed to an intentional mistake or a serious mistake? What's a serious mistake if not missing a title, a lien?
Well, I think in this court's holdings, this court has recognized in 4 of its 5 decisions on equitable subrogation that one of the purposes of the doctrine is to provide relief from mistakes so long as the competing lien holder is left in no worse position through application of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. This court did have the occasion to encounter a case which is a rare situation in State versus Jones, in which the lender itself instructed the title agency, deliberately instructed the title agency, to withhold recording its mortgage for a period of 97 days. So there was deliberate conduct on the part of the lender and the title company that was hired in that particular case to refrain from recording the mortgage. And in the meantime, the intervening lien was recorded. So that deliberate conduct by the lender and the title company in that case actually caused the loss. Now, appellant makes an argument based upon State versus Jones and tries to say that this court did not follow the traditional view of the doctrine in State versus Jones, but in actuality in State versus Jones, the lender asserting the doctrine never provided evidence to this court that it actually intended to hold the first and best lien in that case. In fact, this court's decision referenced that that loan was at least in part for business purposes.
So in that case, that you, the Jones case here, there's the first prong is not met. In other words, there was no intent to be the first and best by the delay in the recording. Now let's move on to what's a mere mistake.
Well, Your Honor, the second point in State versus Jones is also important because that wasn't met either. And that is the most important point. In that case, the lender asserting the doctrine never provided evidence that the competing lien holder, in that case, the state of Ohio, had the expectation that its lien would be junior at the time that it received its interest. So the traditional elements of the doctrine simply weren't met in State versus Jones. And with respect to whether a mistake is made, this court has dealt with a variety of situations in which there was a mistake, in which there was constructive notice. And in fact, in Joyce versus Dance, it appeared that there was actually actual knowledge on the part of the party asserting the doctrine in that case. And this court has said, so long as it is a mistake, so in fact, in Joyce versus Dance, even if there is actual knowledge, the doctrine should still apply. This court perhaps swung the other way in distinguishing State versus Jones, which dealt with deliberate conduct. I think the Court of Appeals in its decision when it referenced...
So are we to say that mere mistake is anything short of deliberate or collusive conduct?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. My suggestion, I believe the Court of Appeals in its decision referenced mere mistake because that actually is the dividing point between right now the traditional view and the moderate view and the minority view. The minority view essentially says if there is a mistake, then the doctrine of equitable subrogation should not be applied. And that was a major part of oral argument before the 8th District. So I think the point of the 8th District's decision was Ohio Supreme Court precedent recognizes that if there is a mere mistake, that is not sufficient cause to deprive a party of its right to assert the doctrine of equitable subrogation, so long as the other party is left in no worse position. The issue of the definition of mistake, I believe, is appropriate for another day. I think it would be appropriate for this court to provide guidance in answering the certified question, which will give guidance to courts of appeals and trial courts throughout the state of Ohio on which view of the doctrine of equitable subrogation applies, and then allow case law at the trial court level and court of appeals level to flesh out circumstances in which it may be a mistake and it may not. And this fact pattern doesn't really suit providing a definition on that issue.
So that in this particular situation, the ABN is limited to the amount of the original mortgage, even though it expended more money than that, probably at the time it paid it off, about $8,000 more. So they're going to be short $8,000 if this property sells for its appraised value, or less than its appraised value because of the economy. The county is short $7,500 that they're not going to see, correct? The gentleman that owned the property will ABN have recourse against that individual?
Well, Your Honor, in actuality, Jacob Kanga filed a Chapter 13 bankruptcy petition.
Okay.
And ABN obtained relief from stay. It was after this foreclosure case was filed. It was 5.5 years after this loan was entered into.
So you're not going to go against him for any deficiency?
I don't believe that's correct. I don't believe we are, Your Honor. I believe ABN is focused on this property.
And the county cannot go after him by virtue of the agreement that they've had. So what's the liability of the title company here?
Your Honor, the liability of the title company should be irrelevant in this court's analysis as to whether the doctrine of equitable subrogation applies.
I'm curious.
Your Honor, it depends first and foremost on the policy documents. I'm representing ABN in the case. So throughout the state of Ohio, as Judge Carr analyzed this point to some extent in a decision he decided 2 months ago in Randleman versus Fidelity, and he recognized that throughout the state of Ohio, there are varying form of title products that relate to due diligence in real estate transactions. Sometimes there's title insurance policies, sometimes there's not. There was testimony provided that there were 45 lenders in the state of Ohio that routinely did not purchase title insurance. Sometimes it's an attorney opinion letter, especially in certain parts of the state. Sometimes there's an abstractor. So what the ramifications are of liability on a title agency or a title abstractor, or title attorney, or title insurance company will depend upon those contract documents. And that's one of the points that we've made in response to appellant's argument, that it's putting the cart before the horse, asking for courts to engage in a recovery analysis on what recovery rights exist doesn't exist in any other area of the law when it comes to deciding whether an important legal doctrine like equitable subrogation actually applies. That's a completely separate case that hopefully we would never have to get to.
Counsel, your red light's been on for a long time, but I want to come back and to the interest rates that you, the interest rate on the first that got taken out was what?
Your Honor, that interest rate is actually not part of the record.
But you've told us it was going up 2.5%, so you've...
It was, Your Honor.
Part of what we know now.
Part of the record, Your Honor, is the mortgage that was satisfied, that was held by Countrywide, and that mortgage attaches an adjustable rate rider, and it said that that note was scheduled to adjust 2 to 3 months after this refinance took place, up to a maximum of 2.75% beyond the then existing rate.
But you're not going to tell us what that is.
Your Honor, that's actually not part of the record. The note that corresponds to the Countrywide mortgage is not generally part of the record because the focus in these lien priority disputes.
So what was your interest rate?
6.5%, Your Honor, and it was a 30-year fixed rate.
Okay, but if I calculate it right on the loan, if it adjusted 2.5%, it would have gone up $1,500, $1,600.
Well, Your Honor, I think at any point in time, interest rates in the state
on an annual basis, but instead he's out $7,500 for the privilege of having your loan.
Well, I think it's reasonable to assume a couple of things, Your Honor. A person generally doesn't engage in a refinance transaction unless their monthly payment is going to be reduced, first of all. Second of all, this was a one-year ARM that was scheduled for a 2.75% increase, and interest rates in the state of Ohio generally, even on an ARM, have not dropped below 4%. So even if you add 2.75% to 4%, that's 6.75% that was the potential adjustment in the first year, and then that adjustable rate rider to the mortgage that was satisfied in favor of Countrywide goes on to state that it can continue to be adjusted every month thereafter. So I think it's reasonable to assume that Jacob Kanga understood that he was facing increased interest rates, increased payments, and the only result here through application of the doctrine of equitable subrogation is that ABN steps into the shoes of the prior lien that satisfies it only in that amount.
Just so you understand, where I'm going in my mind is when we start talking equities, I think all the equity should be on the table. And I'm not sure that having a loan with your client actually enhanced his equities.
Your Honor, I also think it's important in these situations, the doctrine of equitable subrogation has over 100 years of this court's precedent and multiple intermediate appellate courts. The law on equitable subrogation has become extremely refined related to elements that should exist in a particular case. And I think one of the important aspects of this court's ruling is to give guidance to trial courts and courts of appeals as to what those elements are so they don't have to engage.
That's why we have the case here.
In a gut check or pure equity type analysis based upon elements.
I think the issue is the equities between the lenders, is it not here?
That's right,
Your
Honor.
That's a legal issue.
That's right, and that's what the elements of the doctrine are focused on. And the primary element under any of the views of equitable subrogation is preventing a windfall to the competing lien holder that would result and will ultimately result in increased costs. If in situations like this, lien holders that bargained for a junior position at best, sometimes they didn't bargain for any position in the property, fortuitously, surprisingly find themselves in a first lien position, then lenders like my client and third-party service providers will suffer losses that will ultimately have to be passed to consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Sikora.
Thank you.
Ms. Perk, you've saved a little more than 2.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, to answer the question about the interest rate, that's true. It is not part of the original record, but it My information is the original first mortgage was 8%, and it was adjustable, could have adjusted up or down.
Does that bear on our legal issue here, do you think, or?
Well, if it wasn't part of the record, I guess it's not part of the equities that can be waived.
Or being asked by the certified question, I think, to adopt a principle of law, and I guess I don't understand why that's part of the issue of law here.
Oh, it was just a question. It was a question that was asked that I had the answer to.
I just wondered if you thought it was an issue.
Not until yesterday, when I found out what the interest rate was, I thought it might come up. So, but it was not part of the original record.
Counsel, let me ask you, how is the? I'm still not clear how the county is out anything more than it would have been out if there had not been a refinancing. Since they're only asking for what they paid off the original mortgage, and I think also there's some taxes here that was paid with the refinancing.
They are out because the property was over mortgaged, making it more likely for Jacob Kanga to walk away from the property or to go into default.
He had bigger payments after the refinancing?
No, the payments were smaller. I'm not sure what the total sum of the payments under, you know, versus, you know, what they were under the old first mortgage, because there is private mortgage insurance involved and things like that, what the total payments are. I don't think they were too far apart. But when a homeowner is, the property is over mortgaged, they don't see their equity rising. They don't have an incentive to, you know, keep making their payments maybe as they would if they saw their property value rising and their equity rising, making it more likely for them to fall into default or walk away or just say, I don't care about this property anymore. That's the prejudice, making it more likely that this property would fall into foreclosure.
What is your response to Mr. Sikora's argument that the cases, that at least four of the cases we've decided, in those cases, there was not in the, I think I understand, if I'm misstated, then you can correct me, that in the mortgages in those cases, in the first mortgages, that there was no language referring to taking a second position. Is that your understanding?
I'm sorry?
Is that your understanding of those cases? His point is, I guess, that it's to your point that in the first Ohio mortgage, the first mortgage here, that there was this reference to the county being in a second place to the first mortgagor here, and you're relying on that quite heavily. I took it from your first argument that you took a second place only to that first mortgagor or mortgagee, and he says, well, but in the cases we've decided, there wasn't any language. So what's the significance of that, do you think?
The significance, I think, it goes to the intent and expectation of Cuyahoga County that they would be subordinate only to the first Ohio mortgage.
And you said you look at the record, I guess, and the record here would be that your mortgage was second in priority originally.
Originally.
And so that, I guess, we decided that indicates that you were satisfied as a lender to be second in priority. And so why shouldn't that then, again, applying the traditional view, if that's what we apply, that why shouldn't that then carry through when there's a refinancing?
If the parties had intended that to carry through, they could have included that in the contractual documents, and they didn't. The contractual documents, which speak for themselves, indicate that Cuyahoga County agreed to be subordinate only to the original first mortgage in that amount.
So you read that as a restriction on the equitable subrogation?
I don't know if it's so much a restriction. It's an expression of the party's intent at the time they entered those agreements, the mortgage and the loan agreement.
Ms. Perk, if there were a third mortgage in this instance, just assume a new roof or something, and there was a material man's lien on that property. If ABN only takes the first $69,000, you'd be the second lien. What happens to the third lien? Does ABN get its balance before that roofer?
It would probably be a dispute between ABN and then the material man, because the way the trial court held was, I guess, take out the issue of the bankruptcy and whether they can pursue a deficiency judgment. The ABN is, according to the lower courts, in first position for the value or the sum that they paid off the original first mortgage.
Yes.
Then we're second.
Yes.
And then
are they third? Is there some third lien? I mean, I don't understand how that judgment works. That's
what
I'm asking.
Yeah. In Cuyahoga County, I believe that the trial court generally only prioritizes the first three in their judgment entries, and then if there's any money left over, then the parties would have to file a motion for a supplemental order
of
distribution.
But does ABN get a third position? Or do you know?
I don't know the answer to that.
The Court of Appeals didn't address it, I don't think.
It's probably not going to be an issue because there's probably not going to be any money left anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burke.
All right, thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.